lives. Between the Abominator and the dad of a shot-down Jordanian pilot, it is a world gone mad. You know, one of the things that bothers me the most about Christmas is the militarization of the holiday. And what did the Abominator have to say in his Christmas Day address? That we're able to hug our families because there are those who are serving our country and the military who are willing to hug theirs goodbye. Bullcrap.
Yeah, bull you couldn't crap. Hug your family if you didn't have guys over trashing somebody else's country, could you? I mean, how could you do it?
In the most twisted possible political propagandist way, how is somebody from America bombing and killing and destroying Afghanistan and Iraq? Make it possible for me to hug my family. What is the correlation between their belligerence, their invasion of those countries, them breaking those countries, them making a bad situation worse in those two countries, and me being able to hug my family?
Well, because the price of rice in China is $1.10 per kilo today, and it takes 13 pancakes to build a doghouse. You know, that's why. How's that?
Pure insanity. This mythos that our military provides American freedom is an absolute lie. And if you have to sell something as expensive as $1 trillion a year on a lie, you ought not have it.
I want to interject.
All our military does is make us more vulnerable.
Yeah, and I want to interject something here. If this is so true. If this is so true, and Islam is poison, it is that's the truth about Islam. It's just poison.
It's a disease.
You cannot separate what's taught in the Quran from what fundamentalist Islamists are doing, which is jihad, murder, rape, enslavement. So Minnesota feds, the feds come out and they force Minnesota to accept a mosque. In St. Anthony Business Center, right. At least it's appropriately named, because I do think the two religions will merge. What are we doing building mosques in the United States while we're supposedly trying to fight off Islam? See, this is the nonsense. And why aren't, if there's any truth to what they're doing, look, if I was a jihadist, what I would do is just come across the border. Along with all the other Mexicans and everybody else. I've just come across.
Think of this father who just said to the his son was flying a U.S. military F-16, which is the problem with this whole Middle East situation with Islam. America supplies all the weapons. That his son was flying an American F-16, and his son was engaged bombing to kill members of the Islamic State.
That's right.
And then the father says, but we're just all Muslims. You know, treat my son well, Islamic State, because we're all Muslims. Well, if you're just all Muslims...
He was trying to kill you, but take care of him. He's going to get treated worse than anybody.
Imagine the insanity of a father saying, my son was trying to fly an American weapon of war to drop American bombs on you to kill you. And now that you have him captive, you should treat him well. Just forget about the fact that he was trying to kill you.
Well, imagine the insanity of a Congress that gives $500 million to, quote, the Syrian rebels. And all these patriots get behind it. Who do they think the Syrian rebels are if they're not ISIS?
The very people we're bombing.
Why did we give them $500 million?
Justify spending $1 trillion on your war machine if you don't have an enemy to use your war machine on. And since Muslims are incapable of developing weapons that would justify the use of a U.S. military, we have to supply the weapons so that we now have an enemy that justifies our deployment of our military.
Well, thank you. I mean, you just gave it to him. You should give that speech on some kind of a national platform, yada.
Yes.
And then just walk off the stage and see how everybody feels about it. You know, I don't like seeing people running around with missing limbs.
No, I don't.
And having
decapitated. I don't like the thing that bothers me the most about this whole thing. Let me finish with the comment on the father. And we're all Muslims. The fact is that if the world was all Islamic, what you would continue to see is ungodly war. That even if when the whole world surrenders to Islam, if that were to occur, as the eighth surah of the Quran demands, Muslims would do exactly what they're doing. In the Islamic State's war, virtually all of the fatalities, all of the carnage, is Muslims killing Muslims, Muslims raping Muslims, Muslims beheading Muslims, Muslims torturing Muslims. And so this notion that the majority of it is the Muslims against minority communities, that's absolute nonsense. The vast preponderance of the pain is Muslims perpetrating this against Muslims. Now, this is the point I wanted to make. In Saudi Arabia today, there are two women that are going to be dragged into the Saudi Arabian terrorist court. You know what their crime was?
You tell me.
Driving a
they
car.
They got raped?
Nope.
What?
Driving a car.
Oh. Driving a car in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, driving a car in Saudi Arabia, and they're going to be brought into the Saudi Arabian terrorist court. Driving a car, a woman driving a car, is a terrorist act in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Because it's illegal for a woman to drive a car in Saudi Arabia. It's illegal for a woman to leave her home without her husband or her father or an adult male relative. It's illegal. It's illegal for her to go outside without wearing a tent. And yet this is an American ally that American riches to the tune of more than $1 billion a day. One of the largest purchasers of American weapons in the world. Maybe the largest purchaser of American weapons in the world. The very nation that initiated the arming of the Islamic State and al-Nusra to create a proxy war in Syria. Islam is at war with women. Islam is at war with all non-Muslims. And Islam is at war with itself. Why would we provide weapons, provide money, provide moss and support to a religion that's at war with everyone, including itself? Why would we do that?
Well, that's insane. It's insane on its face.
It is insane. It's insane on its face. Mm-hmm. Praise Islam in the White House, and then out of the same breath that you're praising Islam, devote the U.S. war machine to killing the most pure practitioners of the religion. That's all. Religions are rotten to the core. It's just that Islam is the most deadly today. But you know, the second thing I wanted to bring up was that the Pope, his whole midnight mass, Christmas mass, was condemning religious prosecution. Well, if that isn't the pot calling the kettle black, I mean, if you were to trace persecution over human history, the institution most responsible for persecuting those that wouldn't submit to it, surrender to it, is the Roman Catholic Church. And not only did they persecute, but they were the most aggressive devotees of terror and of torture of any human institution. No institution used robbery, terror, fear, and torture as long or as successfully as the Roman Catholic Church. And then he goes on to talk about the inappropriateness of little boys and little girls being forced to serve in the military and of being raped by religious edicts. And yet the Roman Catholic Church is the largest perpetrator of pedophilia of any human institution in history. I mean, does this man need a mirror?
I'm with you, and I don't understand. I'll never understand the delusion or the irrationality of people that sit around and say they want to, they're pleasing God as they oppose him, especially on days like this.
Two popes ago, the Roman Catholic Church, under a papal edict, actually outlawed the use of a single name. Was that name Allah?
No, it was actually, they said Yahweh, but Yahweh's name. They took Yahweh's name, they outlawed it, but in that same edict, they said Allah was okay to use.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the Roman Catholic Church has been fighting a legal battle in Indonesia and Malaysia for the right to use Allah's name everywhere Yahweh's name appears in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. So in their Bible translations, they're fighting for the right to use Allah.
Well, I said, I think the two will merge again, just like Babylon, and I really believe that. I think that's what's going on. You know, give them a few years.
Yeah, it's it is so incredibly sad that some 3 billion people with Christianity and some 1.5 billion people with Islam have been fooled with religious dogmas that are so obviously untrue. I mean, the Quran, from beginning to end, is just a pile of lies, but so is the entirety of the Christian New Testament.
Very strange that Muhammad called them all the people of the book, although he wanted the other two people in the books, Christians and Jews, all killed.
Right.
And he didn't say Judaism. He never used Judaism. He said Jews. So he just looked at it as a race he wanted to.
Yeah, Yahoo. Yeah. In fact, he could. And since Arabic is Hebrew, the Arabic alphabet is the Hebrew alphabet, and almost every important word in the Quran is actually Hebrew, not Arabic. The reality is he used Yahud to speak of Jews, which is related to Yah, and yet he was not smart enough to realize that they were called Yahud because it means
related
to
Yah.
To Yah.
No, of course he was illiterate, but you know when he prescribes things like Christianity being part of it, well then he's off. You know, Judaism, Christianity, that's all part of this one big happy love affair he has.
Well, yeah, I would
think he wants the other two groups dead.
My favorite deception in Islam is one that Christians don't appreciate because Christians are so deceived. But when, and we'll return to this when we return to Shattering Myths, but when Islam speaks of the person that has been translated into English as Jesus, it's not using Yahusha, even though they can write Yahusha in Arabic. No, it's Esau. And we'll return to consider the implications. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. The Quran is filled with 1,000 lies, but one of those lies, if not two of those lies, are germane to the discussion that we've been having about Christmas and about being a Christian, because the names of the holiday, the name of the religion, and Christ are all completely false. It's just as when rabbis initially, and then Christians following them, removed Yahweh's name from his Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And then they changed Yahusha's name, which is really Yahweh Saves, from the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, as well as the witness writings. They made it possible for Islam to exist. And they made it possible for Islam to exist because Muhammad could claim that Allah was the God who authored the Torah, who had relations with Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moshe and Dode and that was the God who created the universe because, well, that God no longer had a name because of what Jews and Christians had done to his testimony. And had they not done that, it would have been impossible to promote the myth that Allah was God. Impossible. Islam would have died in Arabia. The first time it confronted an informed, enlightened community, they would have said, wait a minute, but no. God's name is Yahweh. He says that's his only name. Any other God by any other name is a false God. Your Allah is a rock god. Come on. Go away. And the second would be by Christians at the Council of Nicaea changing Yahusha's name to Iesus and later to Jesus. They made the Quran appear credible when the Quran actually calls his name Esau. But
and that brings us to Malachi, who says, "Was not Esau a brother of Jacob?" Declares Yahweh. I love Jacob, and I hate Esau.
Right.
Yeah, I have caused the his mountain ranges to be lifeless and desolate, his inheritance a desert for jackals and serpents. Yeah, that's what he thinks of Esau. Yet that's the Quranic Messiah is Esau.
Yeah, that's the second most important Islamic prophet after Muhammad is Esau. Yahweh says he hates. I mean, it's so obvious that that's influenced by Satan, and that Satan in doing it is saying, Yahweh, these people that you seem to love, that you have offered so much to, that you seem to care so much about, are so stupid, are so moronic, are so worthless. I will name your son Esau. And a book that I will create that a billion people will view as the Word of God, and they won't figure it out. That's how stupid they are. I will show myself spending all of my time in hell, and they won't figure out that I'm really the adversary, not God. That's why do you care about these people? They're stupid. And guess what? He's right. It is so obvious, Larry, that Christianity is false, that there is no Christ, that there is no term, godly term Christian, that there is no church, that there is no Christmas in association with the real God, that it is astonishing that today billions of people are celebrating this holiday. And what's wrong with people? Why have they decided that thinking is no longer something that's important? Why do they believe that God doesn't really care? That's not what Christmas means to me, and it makes me feel good. So, you know, it's your problem. I'm going to celebrate it. I know.
I'm in a pretty good debate here, right here. You might enjoy this, Yada, with a Messianic Jew that's saying, what's wrong with the Talmud? You don't understand Paul because you don't understand the Talmud. I said, well, besides the fact it's, you know, really a piece of garbage, what am I missing here? It's in direct conflict with the Torah.
Well, you know, it's amazing, too, about the Messianics because they embrace Pauline Christianity and Rabbinic
and the
Judaism.
Talmud.
Yeah, well, Rabbinic Judaism is based on the Talmud. What they don't recognize is that it is impossible to equate Paul's assault on the Torah with the Talmud. It's impossible. And so all of Paul's condemnations are against the Torah. But even should it be possible, and it's not, that his assaults are against the Talmud, the oral law of the Jews, then how can you be a Messianic and embrace the Talmud? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. All of it really boils down to knowing who God is, which tells you who God is not. And this challenge that you're having, well, you're not really having a challenge, but the challenge that the rabbinic Christian is having, this blending of two religions, you'd have to look at Yahusha. When he was speaking to the rabbis, and the rabbis at the time had the Jerusalem Talmud, about 400 years later they would have the Babylonian Talmud, which you just expanded on the Jerusalem Talmud. When he was speaking to them and he was comparing what they were saying to what the Torah said, didn't he point out how the differences were subtle and yet they missed everything because of the way they interpreted or twisted Yahweh's intent to serve their own agenda?
Oh, sure.
So Yosha spoke against the Talmud and in favor of the Torah. And even if you were to forget about the moment for a moment that Yosha told us that the Torah was first and foremost, and that he condemned the Talmud, and actually identified the Talmud. He says, in your writings. But doesn't the Torah say, don't add anything to it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, he even told him. He said, look, he said, because of what you've done, okay, this is over in Yahu. He says, on a mountain high, you've arrogantly put in place and fashioned, raised up and advocated your own deathbed and bier. And indeed, you've quickly become witnesses for lifting up Allah, the perverse and unrighteous one, killing the living in an act of religious worship to gain favor with a religious deity.
Yep. There you go.
You know, I mean, that's what he told the rabbis. Your rabbinic way doesn't work. Look what you've done.
All right.
You know, he also told them
Did Yosha say anything about calling somebody a rabbi?
Yeah, he said never do it.
Right, and the all of the citations in the Talmud, they're all arguments, and they're all sponsored by what type of person?
Rabbis.
Right. 100% of those who are cited, whose arguments are cited in the Talmud, are rabbis. 100%.
Yeah.
And they're identified as rabbis. And Yosha said, don't allow anyone to call you, and don't call anybody rabbi. And why? Does rabbi mean teacher?
Yeah, there's only one teacher.
No, I know, but rabbi doesn't actually mean teacher.
It means exalted ones.
Exactly. It means to be to exalt, to lift up. And so rabbis took the kind of the satanic idea of wanting to be lifted up above the Most High. Well, the rabbis want to be considered more important and their testimony more important than God's. So they chose the title for themselves, rabbi, from rab in Hebrew, which means to uplift, to lift up, to raise up. And so they're seeing themselves as raised up above the authority of God. It's interesting, by the way, that you would find great similarity between the Talmud and Paul's letters, because the Talmud is entirely based on rabbis saying, but I say. So it's rabbis arguing with rabbis about interpretations, and it's all but I say, which is the theme that Paul used. And by the way, what was Paul before he was the founder of the Christian religion?
Yeah, a rabbi.
A rabbi. Yeah,
or a would-be rabbi. I think he got kicked out of rabbi school.
We really don't know. He claims to have been the best rabbi student, the most zealous rabbi student, but then he claims that the rabbis empowered and authorized him to go off and hunt down and kill followers of the way, and they had not only no such authority, but there was no example of them actually doing anything like this. So it is very possible that everything Paul wrote about his affinity with the rabbinical Pharisaic schools would have been a lie. I mean, it's very possible that everything he said was a lie. There's no reason to believe him. But if what he wrote is true, he was a rabbi before he became the wannabe apostle.
Yeah, wasn't he a tent maker, though, or something?
For a brief period of time, he claims that he went back to making tents and Tarsus. But, you know, again, one of the things that differentiates Yahweh's witnesses from those who are pretending to speak for God, like Muhammad and Paul, is they not only can't predict the future, and their prophecies don't come true, in other words, like the case with Paul and Muhammad, they can't even get the past right. The prior history is something that they have a tendency to run awry. And, you know, if you look at Paul's account of the single most important day of his life, where he encountered Satan on the road to Damascus, he has three entirely different accounts of what occurred. He couldn't even get his own history right. He has an account of his history presented in Acts and another one in Galatians, and they're off by a total of 3 to 4 years.
I know, it's insane.
It's insane.
Absolutely insane.
Yeah, one place he goes immediately to Arabia and spends 3 years there, and the other he begins preaching immediately in Damascus and ultimately has to flee by being led down in a basket as if he were Moses.
Like a little baby. Yeah.
He was
scared.
Yeah. He can't. If you look at his summation of what happened at the Council of Jerusalem versus the eyewitness account provided by Luke in the book of Acts, there's no correlation. They differ on every significant point.
Yeah, so, it's shocking. And then, you know, when you look at the extant material and see what happens is these guys come up with, you know, well, I've got the Aramaic, which was hidden in a safe somewhere. You know,
yeah, I know.
Or something like that.
I know. Yeah.
Well, we know it didn't exist until, 600 years after the fact.
Right,
We've got stuff from the second century where Paulos is saying he wants to see everybody under the Torah castrated.
Yeah,
now, it doesn't get any more blunt than that.
Wrote it in his own hand. Yeah, wrote it in his own hand.
Yeah, it's the one thing Christians have right, you know. It is the one thing Christians have right. Paul was totally anti-Torah.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. By the way, you know, when we were talking about this tendency of religious wannabes not being able to get history right, the thing that I learned as I was studying the history of Rome and trying to ascertain why Yahweh was A, so antagonistic towards Rome, which is concerning if you're an American because we've copied almost every aspect of Rome. But also to understand the transition between the Roman Empire that ceased to exist 1,500 years ago to the Roman Catholic Church that is trodden the world underfoot today, per the prophecy, is that in the first 200 to 300 years where the Roman Empire transitioned to the Roman Catholic Church, during that period of transition and its immediate aftermath, 100% of the historians were now Roman Catholics, and their accounting of history was so jaundiced, so inaccurate, so obviously twisted for religious purposes, it just makes you want to scream. I mean, it's just, I took the time to cite like 50 of them in that, if you read those chapters in the seventh volume of Yada Yada, I've quoted 50 of them. And the reason I quoted 50 of them is just because there was literally this whole concept of revisionist history, it was born at this time. And so the fathers of Christianity, the religious fathers of Christianity, were overt liars. They were they recreated history to serve their own agenda. And Christmas, by the way, the incorporation of Christmas into Christianity is just one of those examples.
They rewrote the book. I mean, come on. You know, we've got stuff from the second century, and I know you've seen them side by side. I've got notes from your material.
Yeah.
Where I put a verse from a Biblia today against a verse from Yahweh Kanan in the second century, and they do not say the same things. They just flatly say,
I'll talk about recreating history. The most quoted sermon event taken from the Christian New Testament is let he who was without sin cast the first stone.
The one they added the
right and the right and, the woman, the adulterous woman coming up and their Jesus writing something in the dirt and saying since they don't accuse you, I don't accuse you either, when she clearly committed adultery and therefore would be and was involved in an adulterous affair, so she would be in conflict with the instruction that Yahweh etched on the second of the tablets. That whole event is not in any of the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh century codexes of Yahweh Kanan. So here you have perhaps as many as 3,000 or 4,000 codexes and manuscripts detailing Yahweh Kanan's work, beginning in the late first century, going all the way through the seventh century. That entire tale isn't found in a single one of them. It first appears in someplace in modern-day Turkey in the 8th century. And yet, in almost every English Bible translation, the 8th chapter of Jaokanan, the first 12 verses, tell the story of the adulterous woman and he without sin casting the first stone. Didn't happen. It was created by a religious author to annul the Torah. When you tell somebody that, listen, Yosha was Torah observant. He affirmed the Torah. They will say, well, the example of the adulterous woman, adultery is forbidden in the Torah. He forgave the woman. And so there's a proof that he was not Torah observant, that he came
well,
up with
the entire Well, of course that's what it was about. Of course, that's what it was about. It was trying to show that he wasn't Torah observant.
Right.
When can I ask you something? If he wasn't Torah observant, could he have been the Messiah that was prophesied about?
Of course not.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
100%.
Otherwise, how is he the perfect Torah? Passover? How is he perfect if he wasn't perfectly Torah observant? And if he was Torah observant, and he is the example that we're encouraged to follow, then how could there be a single Christian? How can the thing that he observed be the thing that is now annulled? Why would he observe something that has no merit? Why would he be the Passover lamb if there was no merit to Passover?
I'm here. I know these are rhetorical questions. Just keep rolling. You know, these are all good questions you might want to ask yourself if you're still stuck in the circus with a Biblia sun goddess.
Or let's just say you're one of those people who have been so easily beguiled by Yosha's statement what he meant by saying that he fulfilled the Torah was they did away with it. That you believe the Christian explanation that to fulfill means to do away with. And you're not careful enough, you're not rational enough, you're not informed enough to read what Yosha said immediately before and immediately after that, which proves overwhelmingly and undeniably that fulfill does not mean do away with. Beyond the fact that fulfill does not mean to do away with, it means to honor one's obligation. But beyond that,
if you fulfilled your matrimonial vow,
right,
would that mean that you divorced your wife? You
no.
did away with her? What
no.
would it mean?
If
yeah,
you
exactly.
yes, if you fulfilled your obligation to on a loan, you had a promissory note and you fulfilled your requirements on that promissory note. Does that mean that you did away with the note? Does it mean you do away with the promise, or does it mean that you paid the debt in full compliance? Right. You honored your agreement. But let's just say that you're not smart enough to understand that's what fulfill means. What did Yosha say immediately before that? He said, "Do not think that I have come to do away with the Torah or the prophets." So if he says, "Do not think that I have come to do away with the Torah, the prophets, but instead fulfill them," how can you say that fulfill means to do away? I mean, if you're that stupid, if you're that ignorant, he can't help you.
Well, Yahweh doesn't want you around in eternity.
Right.
I don't either.
Right.
I don't either. You might get me killed. Or
right. Yeah. I have
to a black hole somehow.
Right.
Some,
you think that God wants to spend his eternity with somebody that easily fooled, that stupid, that irrational? That you believe that when Yosha said, "Don't think that I have come to do away with the Torah and the prophets, I have come to fulfill it," means that to fulfill means to do away with. That he contradicted himself in the same sentence. Boy, that's a really good God that you got there. And then
schizophrenic, I'd say.
Right, and then
more
what is he?
Schizophrenic than Superman.
Right,
really?
Then what does he follow it with? He then follows it with that not a single yod or tittle, the yod is the letter of Yahweh's name that we talked about.
By
right.
Till the ends of the universe.
Right.
Yeah,
so long as the heavens and the earth exist. Yeah, not a single stroke or a single letter that comprise the Hebrew words of the Torah and the prophets are going to be done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist. You know, can you walk outside? I'm looking out a window right now. I see Earth. I see this big old mountain that's right in front of me. I see the heavens, the sky is right above it. They still exist. So what does that mean about the individual letters that comprise the Torah?
They're not to be passed by.
Yeah.
Not one word of them. Not one letter of them.
Right. Now, what's really interesting here is that teaches us two powerful lessons. The first powerful lesson that teaches us is that since there's enormous aspects of the Torah that can no longer be done because there is no temple anymore, and most of us do not live in Yisrael. There are enormous aspects of the Torah that can no longer be done. Most of us aren't agricultural based. We don't live on farms and grow crops that allow people to go and walk through and harvest some small percentage of our crops. Because of that, there's enormous aspects of the Torah that cannot be done. In fact, even in the instructions on food, three of the mammals being described don't exist and never existed. So it's not something
I know we went over that one.
Yeah, it's not something that you can do. But you can observe everything in the Torah. In fact, the three mammals that never existed depict religious and political institutions, and the distinction of the things that you can eat is that which digests its what it consumes over and over again, so to elicit every possible morsel of nutrient out of what it consumes, and the things that are to be consumed have a separated foot. So that it tells you that in your walk you want to separate yourselves from those religious and political symbols. You can learn something from every word that's in the Torah. Every letter of every word in the Torah can teach you something that is relevant and that is universally and eternally true. And yet, most people think that the Torah is a book of laws to be obeyed, when it isn't remotely possible. And Yosha's own testimony in that regard makes that a ridiculous conclusion. And the Hebrew word shamar, obey, shamar, observe, does not mean keep. And and shama, the Hebrew word listen, does not mean obey.
And Torah doesn't mean law.
Correct. Now, the second part of that that's really interesting is Yosef's statement that every letter of the existing Torah will stay in full effect. And so long as the heavens and earth exist, there is a time when the existing Torah will be counterproductive. It's hard to imagine, but there is a time, and it's a little over 1,000 years from now, where the existing Torah
is remade.
Right, will be counterproductive. Why do I say it's counterproductive? Because the existing Torah, its benefit is it introduces us to Yahweh. Well, would anybody be around 1,000 years from now who doesn't know Yahweh? So that's not
no, they'll all no. They'll, right. they'll know him right. in a relational sense.
Right.
He says,
well, the next purpose of the Torah is to introduce us to the covenant. Will there be anybody around that's not already a member of the covenant family?
No.
The next purpose is to make us perfect, to make us immortal, to have us be adopted into the family, to enrich and empower us. Will there be anyone who is not already the beneficiary of all those things?
Right.
Okay. So now, that part of the Torah, which is the benefit of the Torah, no longer has any merit going forward because we will all be the beneficiary and know and understand these things. But large parts of the Torah, like any fatherly instruction, also tell us the things that we should not do that will cause harm, that will lead us away from God, that are painful. And in eternity, we're not going to be exposed to those things that are harmful and painful. We don't need advice on incest and bestiality, do we?
No, we don't.
No.
We shouldn't. That far gone.
Right. So the Torah as it presently exists is not a useful document in eternity. It's the most essential document to get us to eternity. But once we're in eternity, we need instruction. But we need instruction on, you know, should you stay 1,000 yards from a black hole? You know, how far should you really stay away from a black hole? When you want to go and visit a new planet, is there a proper way of transitioning from energy-based, a spiritual entity, to a material-based entity so that you can actually eat and sing and go off and camp out and explore?
And even present yourself, because you are literally going to be, you know, one of the children of the covenant.
Right.
You know, we may be dealing with other beings. I'm sure we
correct.
Will be.
We will be. And so we're going to need instructions, but their instructions as to how to operate in seven dimensions. Their instructions as to how to transition from energy to a physical based being and back again, how to interact with one another, how to wield this power. And how to remain a unique individual. And I like the fact we all have unique characteristics. We're unique individuals, but yet all be part of the same family. We're going to need those instructions.
And that's right.
Right. And that's why specifically he said it that way. I mean, everything he says is precise. And
well, there's a reason for everything he does. I know that for a fact. You know, you might find out later, you know, what that reason is, but there's a reason for absolutely all of it. I am somewhat, I'm very dismayed by people who have a tendency to jump in the middle of conversations or sharing of the word and throw some wrench in the work as though they were experts when they're actually working with HaSatan. They're carrying water for the enemy.
Yeah.
And yet they feel so self-righteous, haughty, puffed up. They sound like Paul. They really do. I just put a kibosh on this guy putting it out there, what he said, as for yourselves, you've turned many away, causing many to stumble. By your instructions and teaching, you corrupt and invalidate the familial covenant relationships, says Yahweh, of the assembled helpful envoys.
Yeah, there's only one voice that I want to hear when it comes to knowing God, when it comes to engaging in the covenant. It's only one. That's Yahweh's. And I can find his voice in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. I don't find his voice in the Talmud or in the New Testament. We'll be back tomorrow. May God bless you all.